This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk, and today I have the great pleasure of talking to Jeffrey Lewis about, and this is a first, I don't think I've ever had a conversation with a writer about a four-book project. This is called The Meritocracy Quartet, collecting four books written by Jeffrey, each of them published individually, I believe, but all interlinking. Jeffrey, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you, David?
I'm good. So tell me a little bit about the history of these four books before we start talking about the books themselves.
Sure. These books were written, as you say, individually with some bit of space between the writing of each one of them, actually, in the period roughly starting around 1998 and ending around 2007. And initially, I wasn't sure how many books I was going to write or how long this project would go on. But I think about halfway through, I realized there would probably be four books. And I had an idea at some point early on that, well, what do I really know about as a writer? Because I've been writing some TV and writing stuff that I knew a little bit about, but not great. Not so much stuff that I didn't know so much about that I could feel like I was really the authoritative on the subject. And I wanted to tell some kind of story. I knew there was a story in there that was kind of more essential to me and that I hadn't heard or read about anyplace else, if only because it was essential to me. And I settled on the notion of trying to write a book a decade, per decade of elapsed time, about my generation as it reached its maturity and then barreled through its maturity. And the first one I wrote, The Meritocracy Love Story, was set in the summer of the graduation of the class of 66 at Yale, where I did graduate from in 1966. Although I would say it took me a long time to get to that book. That book probably took the longest of any of them to write. And I kept going around and around in different ways. And I can't even tell you now at what point I finally found something that worked, but it wasn't right away for sure.
Well, it's a pretty, I think, an ambitious project to write about a generation, you know, and, you know, because it's, and I think a lot of people, I'm sure a lot of writers think about that and wonder how they can evoke an entire period of time, but you've covering four decades is a pretty large undertaking.
Well, I figured I'd do it snapshot style. I haven't intended to be comprehensive down to the details, but I did
right.
Feel like I could get an image. And let me put in here something because that your second question reminded me, going back to your first question, which is that I'd seen some stuff, some film stuff, made me think that this was a worthwhile thing to do, but that American film or American television would never do it, or if they did it, would do it in a kind of crummy way that I would not appreciate, in a sort of a jazzed up, unpleasant way. And I'm talking about, in the first instance, the 26-hour film of the 60s generation in Germany called Second Heimat in English, or Die Zweite Heimat in, I guess, in German, which was a wonderful thing that this guy Rice, I think, did. I'm not sure the years he did it, but I remember seeing it in the early 90s, in the days after the big earthquake in Los Angeles, because I remember crawling under a chair in the middle of watching one of them. And he really tried to take on the 60s generation over time. I mean, it started when a bunch of kids were going to the music conservatory in Munich in the late 50s, and kind of followed them through that and into the world and into art and politics and quite a lot of other stuff. And I thought, what a wonderful project. But even though I had a really good reputation in TV at the time, I just was, in my gut, knew that there wasn't any way that anyway I would be satisfied doing it, that anybody would, you know, put it up on TV easily.
Well, and it seems like it's, I've wondered about that a lot in terms of, you know, the cultural iconography for this, what we'll call the 60s generation, which I'm a part of and you're a part of. Yeah. And it feels frustrating that there have been so few really meaningful explorations in any art form, whether it's television, film, or books, that have successfully captured the ethos over it. And you, I think what you've done here is really interesting, because I think a lot of the impulse of the 60s generation might be to be sentimental and look back on the kind of golden years as through those kind of, I would say, maybe corrupted lenses of memory. And you've looked backward, but without, I think, having this sort of sentimentality that it would be all too easy to fall prey to.
Well, I know one thing I didn't want to do, but then, leads into a greater specificity about this project. But one thing I didn't want to do was tell a story that was all about pop culture and rock and roll and the stuff that was filtered through the pop culture lens, which is, of course, how we in the media often are led to see ourselves, when in fact, in various ways, all over the country, in different stratas of society, life is actually lived quite differently from that pop culture overview. Now, in my case, I happened to have gone to whatever you call elite schools, you know, like you did, and that colored my actual experience, but also gave me access to a specific strand of American life in the second half of the 20th century, which not everybody had, and which was distinctly different from what you would call the pop culture wash. I mean, if pop culture was going to do it, it would come out like Dynasty or something.
Correct.
And anyway, that was what I wanted to do. And I would mention, it was not only did fly to Heimat in Germany, but there was something done in Italy called The Best of Youth, which I really liked, and kind of did the same thing for Italy. It was shorter. But those two things in particular, I just wanted to do. So I felt like, what can I do that nobody else is doing, for God's sake? Right. And I didn't want, whether I succeeded or not, I didn't want my generation to pass, or at least even my slice of my generation to pass, you know, our guys, so to speak, without taking a shot at it.
Are there other writers, without necessarily saying that you were inspired by them in, you know, in a specific way, but are there writers that you've paid attention to that gave you maybe, you know, a kind of model to follow?
Well, let me put it in a kind of reverse way, because I only discovered this pretty much after I'd written all these books. But, you know, Anthony Powell wrote this series in Britain, the name of which is now escaping me, but was also put on film, which was also pretty wonderful. And his was a far grander scheme than mine. I don't know how many volumes he wrote. But I, in a kind of reverse way, if, that is to say, if I had seen the damn thing on TV before I started writing, it probably would have influenced me. But having said that, you know, I've got pretty idiosyncratic tastes, or not idiosyncratic, specific and narrow tastes in the literature. Like, I mean, if you ask me what's great is Proust. And now there's no way that you're going to find too much relationship between my books and Proust. But what did impress me was about his great novel was not only the beautiful language and exquisite characterizations, but the breadth of ambition in describing not only sort of the existential issues of time and memory, but society. The effort to make to provide a comprehensive view of the bourgeois and aristocratic society in which he both traveled and aspired to. And some of that and I say this with all humility and without saying there's any comparison, but I don't think I ever forget Proust when I'm writing stuff. And of course, for better or worse, one of the leading characters of my books wound up being named Locke, which is one of the Locke was a pretty important character.
Right.
In Proust.
Well, that's a little homage, perhaps.
Yeah.
But that kind of leads me to the question about the title, and I wanted to talk a little bit about your concept, you know, the concept of the meritocracy, which I thought was, at least for me, resonant. And you just mentioned Proust as a kind of chronicler of this, maybe strata of society that he was privy to. Is that how you feel yourself, kind of as the narrator in these four linked novels, where you're thinking of yourself as being in a strata because of external accomplishment, giving you an opportunity to have a window in, or a view of us, you know, of people that you might not otherwise have?
Roughly, yeah. I think the answer is just, there's probably a one-word answer to that question.
I know. I told the answer as I was asking the question.
I think the answer is yes. And yet I would add to that in the end, like most projects that wind up calling themselves fiction, there appears to be more autobiography here than there actually is. The notion of the books are written in a fairly intimate tone, and then there's a first person narrator evident throughout, even in the fourth book, which winds up being only formally a first person narration. And that first person narrator is called Louis, and the settings of each book are rather like settings which in place and time, if you saw where I was, you'd say, oh, he was there then. And yet the way each book develops is actually quite different from anything that happened in my life. It starts off similar and goes off somewhere. I think that goes under the heading of either, you know, people write things in order to try and make a little more sense out of life, or to make life seem to have a little more shape than the randomness of the lives we actually seem
well,
to
that's
lead.
Why it's called fiction.
Yeah, so what actually results may feel more autobiographical than it actually is.
Well, it's been a recurring theme for me in conversations with writers to resist. It's important to resist our urge, which I think is a very modern one, to read into books, read into novels, the notion of the person who's writing it as if it were somehow all fictionalized reality, which, you know, maybe is a mistake. It's something about art. It's a modern mistake, I think, or at least it seems to be.
Yeah, I think it has. It's allied, I think, to a certain extent, with the ease with which we consume movies or filmed entertainment generally, which most of which is, you know, unless it's animation or something substantially more abstract, is based on a kind of one-to-one relationship with the natural world. That's to say, you're looking at a film and you keep looking because the images you're shown correspond to things you recognize from the natural world. And I think it is, I'm not saying film is responsible for this, but I think a large portion of its appeal is simply that we have become increasingly devoted to or addicted to or seduced by the notion that there's nothing more out there than what we see with our eyes and ears. And so the more, as it were, realistic, the better.
Right, which maybe refers also to television, I think, which,
yeah, sure,
you know, is, of course, even more ubiquitous than film. And you were a television writer for a period of time.
Yeah.
And I'm just, you know, I'm curious how...
TV world.
I was thinking about, you know, in my own experience, my father was a writer who started out writing television and then later wrote novels. And I think it was a big transition to go from the sitcom to the novel. And I wondered, you know, for you, you know, you wrote not humorous, you know, sitcom television, you wrote serious television drama, but still, you know, in that form, you followed a formula that was dictated by the time and the pacing of the, you know, of the way television works. And it's really different to go from that, those, you know, kind of episodic weekly stories, to the depth that a novel requires. And I'm just curious about the transition for you.
What
what was that like?
I can start again with a one-word answer, which is hard. And I would add to that, though, I mean, I could elaborate on that easily enough. I was writing fiction before I ever wrote any TV. I was one of these people. I started doing it towards when I was about, I don't know, 24 or something like that. And not getting anywhere particularly, and broke, came out to Los Angeles to try and like make a living, and wrote a bunch of TV, chiefly Hill Street Blues, but some other stuff also, but mostly Hill Street. And after that, and at a point where I felt like, well, okay, I've done that. Maybe I have enough money to get by, and I really ought to get back to what I meant to do in the first place, kind of thinking. It took me a long time both to sort through what was valuable in what I learned writing for, as they say, filmed entertainment in Los Angeles, what was valuable about it and what was really not very adaptive. And the biggest thing that was not adaptive for me anyway, and this doesn't apply to all TV and doesn't apply to all fiction writing, but the desire to please and to attract attention, which certainly most TV that's commercially produced in America, and probably all film that's commercially produced in America, probably all of it, you know, that's a very important factor. The people who succeed or even the people who fail are constantly afraid that somebody's going to stop watching what they're doing, so they better put something exciting in pretty soon.
Right.
And also judge both themselves and others very often. I don't want to be universal about this, but very often in terms of how much other people appreciate what they're doing.
Right. If it's popular, if people love it, then it must be good.
And you get, as a writer, one acquires, one can, you don't have to, but I think I did acquire some habits, some learning in that area, how to do that, you know? Oh, I bet they're going to like this and they won't like that kind of thinking.
Right.
And that could be useful, I'm sure, for many writers of fiction. I mean, probably you could go through the bestseller list and find about 90% of guys or women who, you know, think and feel that way. It didn't seem like that was a worthwhile way to be thinking for me, writing what I wanted to write. And it took a long time to sort of, not so much to undo those habits, because of course they could still be useful. There were times when one have, you know, be able to call them up, but to try and find out in myself what it was that was making me do what was otherwise a fairly arduous and unpleasant activity, which was sitting around without anybody else around trying to write something. So there obviously was something driving me, but getting it out, locating it, and staying close to it enough so that what came out felt halfway like the right thing is not so easy to do, and it required unlearning some of those habits that looked, you know, outside. What was the, you know, that sociology from the 50s, there was the interior, you know, what was it, exterior-oriented, interior-oriented?
Oh, right. Yeah, I think I remember that, I think.
I don't remember the names, though, of, you know, the immediately. But anyway, you get the inner-directed, other-directed.
Right.
Those are the old sociology. To become inner-directed again after being somewhat outer-directed was not so easy. It took some time, and I don't know if it's ever a job that's completed.
Well, and
I
guess
maybe it shouldn't be completed, because, you know, you don't want to say to the world, go to hell.
Right.
Anyway.
Well, you might. At certain points, you might.
But in my own case, that wasn't my idea. I still like the idea of being loved. So, anyway.
Right, but maybe loved for something different.
Yeah. In any event, that was the hardest piece of transition, that sort of inner change.
And did you feel when you were, these are four separate stories. They're, as we say, interlinked, covering the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, the 90s. And I give the titles of them for, although they'll be written down in the introduction, but it's Meritocracy, A Love Story, The Conference of the Birds, which I loved, The Theme Song for an Old Show, and Adam the King. And I noticed in Conference of the Birds, that was very evocative of that period in a lot of ways. The character, Louis, the main character, is not only working, but also involved in a kind of unusual group of spiritually minded, I recognize the Uspensky and the Gurdjieffian stuff, which has come, you know, really kind of esoteric, but probably the more popular version might have been Est, you know, where there were people kind of following these paths of psychological inner exploration. And that was pretty resonant of that decade. And then, as you said, or as the, you know, as you go in the next decade, it becomes more outer directed rather than inner directed, you know, so your characters do follow the path of that generational change, it looks like.
Yeah. Well, and there I would say, this is not a particularly admirable thing thing to say about myself, I don't think. But I was conveniently placed that way. That is to say, with relatively little resistance, I seem to have followed the path the most of least resistance of my generation.
But maybe in a way that's sort of tautological, maybe that is what the generation of people were doing. You know, obviously not everyone, but a kind
yeah,
of...
Yeah, no, I know. But I found I had very little resistance to the zeitgeist.
Right, exactly. So I think the zeitgeist is the right word, or, you know, it's the... So you didn't have to work hard at being in the moment with everyone else.
No, except that being part of a bit of at least intellectual and maybe socioeconomic eventually elite, it was a little more intellectualized and a little refined, you know, relative to the culture.
Right, but maybe that's the part of, you know, that's the maybe the element that you are representing most.
Yes, it is. It's representing in the very title of this quartet, the Meritocracy
right.
Quartet.
Exactly. I mean, you have to be in the place that, you know, you have to be who you are, and you have to know who the world that you're part of.
So that's what I've done.
Well, I actually think I think it's a really successful collection, and even though it, to me, I have to confess, a little daunting to read four books in a row.
Well, I would say for anyone who might hear this podcast who is interested in these books, that they're actually stand on their own as well, and you certainly don't have to read all four to...
No, that's true.
Get enjoyment, I hope, out of any single one.
That's true, but I think it's... you gain more from reading all of them.
And, I hope so.
And I think that, you know, it's what I want to say is, even though it may appear daunting, you know, the stories really draw you in, and, you know, the characters are, you know, they're people we want to know more about. So I think it's, you know, the reward is there. And I think the, I read a description of the fourth book, which I have not finished reading yet, that, you know, it is kind of an exciting end, so there's, you know, more to look forward to.
I hope so. I hope that's the case. Thank you.
So are you working on other fiction besides these, now that you've completed these and they're, you know, they're being published together? Are you working on something else?
Well, actually, there are two other novels that I've written, and actually have been published in the last, I would say, three, four years. One is called Berlin Cantata, which is a polyphonic novel set in Berlin just after the end of the Cold War, just after the wall opens, and has to do with... more or less, it has probably to do with a lot of things, but it's set in the world where a certain number of Jews are coming back to Germany for the first time, or to Berlin for the first time since the catastrophe, and how that all kind of was playing out. That's that one. And then the second one, which is, for me, you know, it appears different, although I care a lot about history, is called The Inquisitor's Diary. And that is set in mid-17th century New Spain, which is now Mexico and the American Southwest. And to pretty much everyone who saw this book when it came out, he would say, "Oh, then that's a departure," and they were right. It was a departure, and that is set in. It is exactly what it purports to be, which is a diary of a functionary of the Holy Inquisition in Mexico City in 1649.
That was a different
period.
So
I've done those.
Yeah.
I've done those, and I've actually done a couple other things which I haven't dared show anybody yet. And as I sit here, I'm exhausted. I'm looking around for something else to write, but the truth is I don't know what's going to be right now. And I'm not going to, I'm not going to do anything that doesn't really kind of bowl me over to do. It's a lot of work writing one of these things.
Yeah, actually. It is. Clearly.
And, I guess I've proved to myself that I can do it. And I've written a whole chunk of what I really want to write. And what I don't want to do is wind up one of these guys who says, I'm a novelist, so I better write another novel. it seems to me that must be better use of my time. But on the other hand, I am looking.
Well, I hope you find it. But I also hope that readers will find these four books. The Meritocracy Quartet by Jeffrey Lewis. Jeffrey, I want to thank you for talking to me here for Writer's Cast.
Oh, thank you, Jason.
And, good luck with this.
Thank you for that, and thanks for having me.
This has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm David Wilk, your host. I've been talking to Jeffrey Lewis. The book or books are called The Meritocracy Quartet.